The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Judge Larkin, Judge Riley. The Honorable Denise Riley presiding. The next case is A210733, Schultz v. Billy.
Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The arguments will proceed as if we were in person, so each of you will have 15 minutes with 5 minutes of rebuttal for appellant. We had some discussions earlier about Mr. Elsop, who represents the town of Duluth, and it's my understanding he is not splitting arguments with Mr. Johnson. And so please state your name at the beginning of each argument. These arguments are being recorded and will be posted on our website. If at any time you are having technical difficulties or you can't see us or hear us, please raise your hand and we'll stop the clock. We want to make sure that you have your full time for argument. And with that, is the attorney for the appellant ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Then you may, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Your Honor. David Johnson, on behalf of appellant Carol Danielson Billy, who I believe is joining us at a separate location. As you're aware, the first issue involved in the appeal relates to the application of collateral estoppel to bar my clients from making their second variance application. And as I've outlined, collateral estoppel has never been applied by any Minnesota court previously to a land use or variance decision. And to do so was error for four separate reasons. And the first of those reasons is that this court and the district court lack authority to apply that doctrine for the first time. And obviously, I'm not super thrilled about leading out my arguments with an argument that you don't have authority to do something is not my preference. But in fact, it's your own rule from the Tester decision, which was an asbestos case, in which you said that aggregation of fault as a legal doctrine could not be expanded or extended by either the district court or the Court of Appeals, but rather it was an issue for the Minnesota Supreme Court or our legislature because it involves public policy decisions. And that same reasoning and logic and rule of law applies in this case to bar application of collateral estoppel to these circumstances.
Let me ask you this. Do you think that this case should be precedential? And if so, what would the syllabus point be? And I'd ask Mr. Paul the same to also answer that question when it's his turn.
Okay. Yeah, I guess I would prefer that you support and affirm Tester in that regard and point out that on issues like this, and certainly if depending on the resolution of this case, I'm confident in the other issue that this case should be remanded with an order to enter summary judgment in favor of my client. But certainly I think if either party seeks further review by the Supreme Court, they would want a precedential decision as to how you view that issue.
Counsel, could you just address for me, I'm having a difficult time understanding how we got to collateral estoppel in this context. I mean, it's a judicial doctrine that applies to judgments. This isn't a judicial decision-making process. We don't have a judgment. I mean, what is the argument that got the judge to do this?
I think my interpretation was that there was a great deal of frustration on her part as to the timing between the two variances, that it was only 2.5 weeks. And she found that the differences that were between the two variance applications both didn't directly relate to the variances at issue. And she felt like that, and then she went through an analysis of whether to apply collateral estoppel to which types of circumstances. And there is certainly a very lengthy opinion. And I don't, while there's numerous errors and reversible errors, the length of the analysis and the thought that was put into it, certainly I don't question whatsoever, but it was, erroneous, I believe, to do so.
Just to be clear, Mr. Johnson, was collateral estoppel argued by the neighbors below before the district court?
Yes, collateral estoppel was advanced by the neighbors, and I brought up the Tester decision and quoted it in the oral argument because I just joined the town's brief on the substantive issues, but I also raised the fact that the court doesn't have authority to extend this doctrine in any event under Tester. And I believe respondents argue that that wasn't a proper reservation of the issue, but I quoted the case, the rule of law, and certainly as I pointed out in my reply brief, it also is analogous to a jurisdictional issue that you can't waive in any event. If a court does something that it doesn't have authority to do, certainly, and that would be consistent with a Tester decision, it doesn't look like possibly either party even raised that before the court did on its own initiative. The second reason is if you actually entered into those public policy considerations, just like the court rejected res judicata based on flexibility of land use decisions, similarly changing preferences as far as economic development. I believe the town also points out that they as well should be the ones that allow and other municipalities to make decisions if they're afraid of serial applications to prevent that type of thing. They can make their own rules, and those rules are far more efficient because trying to assign to a town board, you know, this 17-page collateral estoppel analysis that the district court does, it's just simply not workable anyway. So I believe the town pointed out that there are other municipalities that do put in time restrictions or try to prevent this type of thing with their own rules, which is really the way that it makes sense. The third reason is the injustice to my client. Collateral estoppel never applies if there's an injustice to the party. In this case, my client would have no notice whatsoever that this could bar her from her application. And then that injustice is coupled with the fact that the town instructed her and her husband to reapply. And so I can't imagine a bigger injustice to now say that a court swoops in and says that what the town told you to do was not going to, it was going to be mute. It was, you know, no possibility of it being effective. It just doesn't make sense. The other great injustice in this case is that the basis for the respondent's complaint and the neighbor's complaint was false anyways, that this idea that the house was going to block their view of Lake Superior, that the Supreme Court recited as the reason why they deserved their day in court, is false. It's false. It's proven by the photograph that was allowed into evidence on the summary judgment hearing. It's also proved false by the town of Duluth's own findings on that point. So you can imagine the frustration of my client having to now step in under these circumstances. Now, the last reason then that it doesn't apply is that there were material changes between the two applications. Collateral estoppel doesn't apply when there are any substantive changes between the applications. And the district court improperly rejected that argument because it found that the changes were considered as part of the first application. But with all due respect, I think that was quite hypocritical for a court to do that because the variances were in fact different. And to say that the town didn't feel, or some of the decision makers didn't feel bound by the four corners of the first application, and that's the reason why they told them to reapply, because those things were in fact important to them. So to say that, well, they argued it during the first application and somehow that bound the town of Duluth, certainly courts are bound by the pleadings, and there's no reason to believe that at least some of the decision makers with the town didn't believe that they were also bound by the four corners of the first variance application. And the things such as the pitch of the roof were important enough as far as the neighborhood character, and the things that are in fact relevant to those parties or to their decision, that they made them reapply. And so Mr. those Johnson, are the Yep.
So if we agree with you on your first argument, then we get to your second argument, which challenges the merits of the district court's decision. I have two questions about how we review that. First of all, do we give any deference to the district court's decision?
No, I don't believe so. It would be a de novo review, I believe, Your Honor. And it's the Van Landeschoot case that sets out the standard of review with respect to the fact that you review the factors and determine whether there's any slightest validity to any of the factors that would then makes them reasonable. And I submit that that's in essence the reason why this is the first court that's ever reversed a variance or land use decision, at least to the Court of Appeals level that we know of. And the reason for that is you cannot imagine a more, you know, discretionary standard of review. All it has to have is the slightest validity. And this case brings to bear the fact of why is that rule there? Because it's not workable to have anything else. What you end up with is a potential to have happen what exactly has happened to my client, where you second guess, or there's a threat of second guessing the town. And then according to the district court, my clients would have to wait the 30 days for the appeal to run. And now 3 years of incredible Bleak House litigation to wait to build their home. If every economic development had to wait at least the 30 days and then a neighbor to threaten to bring an appeal and then, hey, pay me money or we're going to appeal this and you're not going to be able to do this for, according to the Billy case, maybe 3 or 4 years. You can imagine not only does that, you know, destroy the interest in economic development, it just, I mean, it's a real battle scar on anybody's view of our civil justice system, what my clients have gone through in this case.
Mr. Johnson, my second question about our review of the town board's variance is, so in the statute, 462.357 subdivision 6, there are, I think, 5 requirements in essence. There's in harmony with, consistent with the comprehensive plan, and then there's the reference to practical difficulties, which has 3 components. So would you agree with me that all 5 of those things are required before a variance can be granted?
Right. I agree that that's the statutory framework, and I think that's the reason for the slightest validity
standard. And just to continue with my question, I'm sorry, but the district court, I think, found that multiple requirements were not satisfied. The district court found error in the town board's decision with respect to more than one of those requirements. Would you agree with me that for us to reverse the district court and to basically uphold the town board, we would need to conclude that the district court was in error with respect to all of those?
I would agree that that would have to be part of your de novo analysis and review of the district court decision. At the same time, there's not a great deal of case law, but the case law that is there, while the statutory framework, I agree with you, sets that up, the language in the actual cases suggests that it's more of a multi-factor analysis. Or, for example, the unpublished decision, the Aranco decision that the court is really cites as its only basis, that talks about the 5 factors that municipality had as a whole. And so I believe that, as I've outlined in my argument, each of the factors that the district court found was not element or not present, all involved the district court deciding that one factor within that element was more important than another, which is exactly contrary to the slightest validity argument. So as you go through my argument, you'll see that on each of those prongs that the court didn't find was present, it's a decision to elevate one factor in the analysis over the one that the town of Duluth found most significant. And that's exactly, it basically turns, you know, the standard of review on its head.
Let me ask you, so Mr. Johnson, I'm sorry to interrupt, but time is running. So I'm looking at Krummenacher, which of course reviewed a previous version of the statute, but still Krummenacher said that the statute requires that these factors be met and that a variance can be granted only if it is determined that it's in keeping with the spirit and intent. Anyway, I think that the Krummenacher opinion tends to basically interpret the statute to have multiple requirements, all of which must be met, rather than a multi-factor balancing test. Do you have any authority to the contrary?
No, other than what I've referenced to the fact that that the standard of review itself is reflective of how it is more of a multi-factor analysis, that if one factor was where you had some criticism in any way of what happened, it's not going to be enough to overcome. You still would look at the your other analysis and you wouldn't say, well, of these multi-factors, I think the respondents slightly prevail, but this one maybe doesn't quite meet the standard. I think that would be inconsistent with the spirit of the standard of review. And in any case,
I'm sorry, so which case are you referring to? Could you?
Oh, the Aranco, the one that the district court, the unpublished decision that the district court cited in its, I think, believe final conclusion of law is consistent with its opinion. That case references the fact that, it refers to it more of a, that none of the factors were satisfied by the objecting party. And certainly doesn't talk about it in a one factor at a time. But I agree with you, Your Honor, that that's the statutory framework. My interpretation of reading the cases is that extraordinarily deferential standard of review allows you to actually look at the entirety of the circumstances with respect to that analysis, which I think, to the district court's credit, I think that's what the district court tried to do. It just made some rather glaring errors in deciding which things it thought were most important. And again, I believe it was in large part what I believe was the frustration over the changing their mind 2.5 weeks later that brought the reason why the district court didn't properly apply that standard of review. I apologize for going over my time, Your Honors.
Thank you. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Paul, are you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor. Thank you. My name is William Paul, and I represent the respondents John Schultz, Rebecca Noreen, and Jack Nelson. And Judge Riley, you asked me to anticipate the question of whether I believe that the decision in this case ought to be precedential. And I respectfully submit that it should be. And the reasons, well, the primary reason is that and Mr. Alsop and I had discussions many months ago about this. There is not a single case in the state of Minnesota that he could find or I could find wherein the application of res judicata and collateral estoppel was applied to a zoning decision. And
so, Mr. Paul, what would your syllabus point be?
The syllabus point would be this. If a township ordinance says that a variance decision of the township is final unless appealed by an aggrieved party within 30 days, that decision is final, binds both the applicants for the variance, the various variance applications sought, and this is very inartful, Judge, I'm sorry, and it also binds the neighbors if they don't appeal. So that would be the syllabus point. When an ordinance says it's final if not appealed, it's final if not appealed. And it is undisputed in this case that the Billies did not appeal the denial of the variance. When the initial application was denied, it is undisputed the denial of those variances by the Town of Duluth Town Board was not appealed by the Billies.
So Mr. Paul, then yes. You would support a rule that property owner and all successors in interest may never request a variance again forever?
Yeah, I, on, in, In the context of this case, Judge Johnson, yes. Now, that would change if something materially changed in the application, or you can never say never. For example, Judge Johnson, there's a case in which the neighborhood, somebody applied for an apartment building variance, it was denied. Then the complexion of the neighborhood changed completely, and years later, somebody reapplied for a permit to build an apartment building. Because of a material change in the application and in the kind of the makeup of the neighborhood, that municipality could then reconsider the application. But in this case, where the lot size is 0.3, that's never going to change. It's impossible to change unless, of course, the Billies or succeeding property owners buy up additional property adjacent to the parcel in dispute here.
Let me ask another question about, and it's more about the case law, collateral estoppel case law. So I believe there is some case law that an administrative decision may be binding on a judicial tribunal, a court, in a second action. I'm not aware of any case law. I mean, the parties seem to agree that there's no case law where collateral estoppel is applied to bar a governmental authority with respect to a zoning variance. But I'm not aware of any case law, even in a more broader way, where collateral estoppel barred an administrative, a non-judicial tribunal from considering a request that is similar to a prior request. Are you aware of any such case law in Minnesota?
No, I'm not, Judge. But there's a plethora of cases, indeed, I believe cited in everybody's submission, maybe not Mr. Johnson's, but there's indeed a Florida Law Review article on zoning finality, conceptualizing res judicata doctrine in land use cases. So Judge Johnson, there are cases from all over the country, not Minnesota, I'm not implying that, that apply the doctrines of res judicata and collateral estoppel in zoning decisions. Now, with that said, and I hope I'm not getting too far afield, the decision of the town board is, as a matter of law, a quasi-judicial decision. I don't think that can be disputed as a matter of law. It's a quasi-judicial decision. And just like the district court judge found, that quasi-judicial decision is subject to the same analysis as if it were rendered by the district court in terms of the context of res judicata and collateral estoppel.
Did you find it interesting that she parsed res judicata and collateral estoppel so closely that she found one didn't apply and one did apply?
Judge Riley, yep, found it extremely interesting, to use your words. I found it interesting, and it seems to me it's kind of a distinction without a difference. In other words, collateral estoppel is kind of a subset of res judicata, and it seemed to me, and I argued then, and I reiterate that argument now, that when the Billies let that 30 days go by, that decision, the denial of the variances, became final. And then if they came back and the town board was filled with court of appeals judges or attorneys, someone would say, well, you let the time go by and the denial is final, and that's final, and it's simply too late. The decision has been made and the doctrine of the thing has been decided would apply. And certainly, obviously, Judge Fountain Lindberg engaged in a really extraordinary, in my career, thorough decision and order, and she ruled the way she did. But that's a long answer. Yep, very interesting to me that she separated the two, but whether it's one or the other, It's barred. And for that reason,
I think Judge Larkin has a question.
Okay, sorry.
I do, and I'm struggling with this because your argument seems to be, I mean, if we're going to talk about policy, you're saying we would prefer to have had this case go to the district court and be litigated there instead of just having people take into account what they'd been told the concerns were, address those concerns and try to resolve them without engaging the district court. Why is that a bad policy? Why would we want this to go to the district court? Okay, maybe then it gets reversed, remanded, you start all over again. I'm having a hard time understanding what's so offensive about the notion of saying, well, it was voted down, here are the concerns, reapply after you've addressed those concerns. I mean, I think we've seen cases where the person goes and asks for the approval and is told, well, we're not going to approve it unless you do X, Y, and Z. And so they sort of back up, make those changes and resubmit it. I have a hard time understanding why what happened here was so egregious that we would take a judicial doctrine that's never been applied in this context and say, we're going to apply it here.
Okay.
But what's the harm we're trying to get at here?
Right. Well, that concern would be valid, not to imply it's not valid, Judge, because you just articulated it was, but that concern would be valid if there was even a minute change, even a scintilla of change between the first application, Judge Larkin, and the second one. But if you look at—
I thought the record indicated that they eliminated a walkout, they added a rock retaining wall, added a deck. I mean, they made changes, right?
Absolutely. And
the changes were in response to the concerns that had been made.
From the town board?
Yeah. No, so, how it's not an identical request if these changes have been made, is it?
It is an absolutely identical application insofar, Judge Larkin, lest I lose credibility, insofar as variances are required. So if you look at the district court's ruling and she, at page 5, she sets forth a chart showing what was required in terms of variances. And they needed a road centerline variance, a nearest side yard variance, a minimum setback variance. Obviously, they needed a lot variance, a minimum lot width variance, and an unclassified water course variance. They did
not. Then are you saying that the town board, getting away from the issue of whether the town board should have considered it a second time, the town board said, well, this is fine now. So are you saying the town board erred in doing that because really nothing had changed?
Absolutely. And forgive me, but Judge Larkin, it's undisputed that nothing changed. The application was identical, I mean, literally identical between the first and the second in terms of the 6 variances that the Billies needed. I mean, literally, it wasn't different by a foot. The lot size stayed the same, the side setback stayed the same, the water line stayed the same. Every single one of those was exactly the same between the first variance application and the second variance application.
What in the local rules or statutes prevented submission of a second variance application?
It would, I would refer you to the ordinance of the town that says the thrust of which is all decisions of the town board shall be final if not appealed to the district court within 30 days. This isn't
the kind of ordinance that Mr. Johnson talked about where it said there we won't consider a second variance. Some ordinances, some towns have included that in their ordinance. Mm-hmm. So, but I want to move on from whether or not collateral estoppel applies. And this is my problem with your argument with regard to the judge weighing the factors that she weighed. And obviously she put a lot of time and thought into her opinion. But the case law, and I'm citing White Bear Docking and Storage right now, the setting aside of routine municipal decisions should be reserved for those rare instances in which the city's decision has no rational basis. And then the Mendota Golf case, even if the municipal body's decision is debatable, so long as there is a rational basis for what it does, the courts do not interfere. And so my view of our review of these municipal decisions is that it's much more differential than even what we give to district court decisions. And so if there's any rational basis in what the town and the zoning, but it was the town board decided, we defer to it unless it's completely irrational. Do you think that's what the law of Minnesota is, the case law?
I agree that a court has to defer to the decision of a variance board, a town board in terms of zoning decisions. I agree with that. Now, with that said,
and that we give it great deference under our case law.
Okay.
Do you agree with that?
I don't think you have to give it strict deference, but I want to answer it this way, Judge Riley. You say, except in the rare cases where, or the rare decision where there is no rational basis. That's what we have here. Because Judge, if you don't agree with my argument that the applications were identical, then with all due respect, you haven't compared the two because they are spot on identical. So either the denial of the variances applications the first time around was arbitrary and capricious and unreasonable, or the grant of them the second time around was arbitrary, capricious, and unreasonable, because this is the rare case where nothing changed. And if you decide to reverse the district court's decision regarding the arbitrary and capriciousness and unreasonableness, there literally will never be a basis for an aggrieved person to appeal to the district court. Because again, the ordinance, Judge Riley, required 2 acres. It was 0.3 acres. If that's not unreasonable on its face, nothing is. I see I've run out of time. I'd love to go on and on. I can't.
It looks like if either of my colleagues have additional questions, Judge Larkin, you're shaking your head. No. Judge Johnson, do you have any additional questions?
Well, I do on that last point, Mr. Paul. I believe that there's evidence in the town board record that numerous lots in that subdivision are not in compliance with the zoning code and have received variance. I'm looking specifically at a PowerPoint slideshow that was presented at by staff at the Planning Commission meeting, which shows 5 other properties have an acre or less and do not comply with the setback requirements. I think the assertion was made that most of the nearby properties do not comply with all of the requirements from which the Billies sought a variance. Is there any contrary evidence in the record that undercuts what I'm looking at?
Well, here's what I would say about that, Judge Johnson. There are many lots on North Shore that have less than an acre with a building on them. That those, I would submit to you, are all pre-comprehensive plan lots. So if a cabin, you know, the North Shore is filled with cabins built in the 20s and the 30s that I'm certain have less than an acre. But the town of Duluth, in an effort to reduce the, to make it look not look like the California seacoast, instituted and implemented the comprehensive plan and decided that a 2-acre minimum lot size, and it's not retroactive. The people that have a cabin that from the 20s and 30s don't have to tear down their building if they're on a 1-acre lot size. I am not aware, Judge Johnson, of any application that was approved prior to this one for development on a lakeshore lot of less than 1 acre. If it exists, you know, I'm not aware of one, and that's all I can tell you.
Thank you. I see that my colleagues have put their mute buttons on, so I assume they don't have any further questions. Sir Johnson, do you have any rebuttal?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to start out by emphasizing and pointing out that the changes that were made between the first and second variants also included a change to the pitch and the roof. And so even if you were to take Mr. Paul's argument about that it has to be a relevant change, it doesn't have to be relevant to directly to the variances at issue. It just has to be relevant to a factor in the town's analysis. Well, one of those factors is the neighborhood character. Several of the changes related to the look of the house and the neighborhood feel, including the pitch of the roof, all of those were directly relevant and could be a reason why some of the decision makers instructed them to make those changes and to reapply. So that argument really is a non-starter. I would like to briefly point out some of the inconsistencies and failure to apply the proper standard of review on the elements that Judge Johnson pointed out as part of your analysis on the arbitrary and capriciousness. The purpose and intent of the ordinance, the district court basically used a litmus test that if it's less than 2 acres, then she criticized it in that regard and said that, well, just because it's consistent with other housing doesn't mean that it satisfies the purpose and intent of the ordinance. That's just elevating one factor over the one that the town of Duluth found more significant. That's not extraordinary deference. That's just second guessing. On the comprehensive plan element, another example, the district court in the final analysis states, while the comprehensive plan does encourage new housing, it also values open space. Again, not saying that didn't apply the standard of whether that's slightest validity, just criticized the town for emphasizing one factor over another factor. Then the factor related to it not being created by the Billies just somehow came up with this idea that since they had previously owned property on the other side of the highway, that somehow that should be held against them, even though they had sold that property 15 months before. If we look at the other part of the district court's analysis, completely inconsistent with that. It talks about rejecting res judicata because there's changed circumstances, that one of the factors that a town considers is the need for economic development and a tax base. 15 months later, they were certainly entitled to decide that, hey, changed circumstances, we're trying to encourage new housing and economic development. When those 15 months pass, it's up to them to decide whether the Billies created their own problem on this, not for a court to come in and then second guess that, not to mention it's a state highway. There's no legal authority that's ever been mentioned or advanced that somehow that should have been held against them. They're like the other neighbors desiring to live on the lake, that the only way to live on the lake is to have a house on the side of that highway. And so again, applying the slightest validity analysis, that should be rejected as well. And then the final factor actually was in fact undisputed. That's the character of the area. Even the district court said it's undisputed that that factor has been met. And so when you march through all of them, as Judge Johnson hinted at, that the court must do as part of its analysis, all of those criticisms really come to heart because it was a lengthy analysis, but there were critical errors made at each point of the analysis. And it's really the crux of the reason why there's never been a case that second-guessed a land use decision in this nature. And I submit, as I pointed out in my brief, the public policy reasons why it would be such a nightmare, both from a legal perspective and from just a social perspective of shovels going in the ground. The court's hinting at
my client shouldn't have, you know, having to wait 30 days and then multiple years of litigation. Quite frankly, I think it's offensive to fairness and to the system that's been set forth and deference that courts should hold towns to. And finally, I guess, if I've got time, the inconsistency with, you know, looking at the reasoning of individual decision makers at the hearing and then attributing that lack of sound logic to the body as a whole. I think that's hypocritical, and it's setting a higher standard than we hold the courts. I don't cite to oral arguments or statements made in oral arguments, and I can't, because that's not what's binding, and it shouldn't be binding on a town when they're discussing these issues to them, have that held against them by a court saying that that's attributable to the body as a whole. And so, again, I apologize for going over slightly, but unless there are other questions, that's all I had to add.
Judge Johnson, I see you're unmuted. Do you have a question?
Just one, if I may, Judge. Thank you. Mr. Johnson, I'm aware that there's evidence in the record that when the Billies purchased the lot, there was a structure on it, a home, and which later burned down. There's some reference during the town board hearing that since their purchase, a ditch was added. I'm not clear what that refers to, and I guess I'm also not clear, how does that relate to the application for a variance? Was a variance made necessary because of the addition of that ditch or whatever it was, or was the situation made more difficult for the Billies because of that?
Right. Thank you, Your Honor. My understanding is that that situation was referenced by one of the decision makers as an additional reason why the hardship was not created by the Billies, and that these setback requirements would have had to have been deviated from, because that would actually constitute, at least under that decision maker's analysis interpretation, as an actual waterway, is the reference that I recall reading. And so they found it significant, and another reason why the Billies didn't create the situation themselves.
So did the addition of the ditch, I mean, was there a taking of some of their property at some point in the past in order to create the ditch?
I don't know the answer. I believe that if there was a taking, it was just in the essence of the easement, not a formal taking of property, but an easement to be able to maintain that ditch and what that one decision maker referred to as a waterway, which again, I would grant you, there isn't a river or anything that runs through the property. Right?
Thank you very much. It's a interesting case. I know it's important to both of your clients, and the case was well briefed and well argued, and we will have our decision out within the 90 days. And that concludes the oral portion of our calendar. We now will move to conference on non-oral cases.